All right. Hi, I'm Brian Cardell. I'm a developer advocate at Egalia.
And I'm Eric Meyer, also developer advocate at Egalia. And in this episode, we're going to do a recap, sort of a look back on a recent TC39 meeting. And for that, we have a couple of special guests. Nick, could you introduce yourself, please?
Yeah. Hey, I'm Nicola. I work at Egalia in the compilers team. Mostly do JavaScript standard stuff. And I've been doing that for many years now.
And Ujwal has also joined us. Ujwal, please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm a colleague of Nick's working on JavaScript standards on ECMA, TC39, ECMA 402, all of these various standards that sort of define the language that we all have a strong opinion on.
Are they strong opinions weakly held? Or strong opinions strongly
Absolutely.
Held?
I don't think any strong opinion should be very strongly held.
Okay.
Are they typed or untyped?
They're duck typed.
You know, I was wondering if, like, just to start us off, I remember, you know, way back when we were like, oh, are we going to get an ECMA 2? And then eventually that became years. So we get like ECMA 2016, 2017, 2018. Like, I haven't personally heard a lot of the same referring to that in that way. I'm just curious, like, do you find that that's still a thing? And if so, like, why is it a thing? Like, when do you sort of determine what's going to be in and what's going to be out? Or are you kind of mostly living standard at this point?
It's true. It's not relevant anymore because we basically have a rolling release. Like features get added to the language, browsers ship them, and then every year we just take a snapshot of whatever state we have and put a year on it. And we need to do that because, like, as part of like building a standard, it's not just like writing down the document on the web page, but we'll need to have some process. We need to have like a little PDF that says this is ECMAScript 2026, for example. So we need to do that. But it doesn't really affect JavaScript developers. And actually, transpilers also move to not care about that anymore. Like, some like TypeScript still have you like say, oh, I want to target ECMAScript 2019. But then other transpilers, somebody might argue they're doing this better. They just let you define what browsers you want to target, so you don't have to care about the year at all.
Cool. So I actually have never been to a TC39 meeting. I've looked at minutes, I've looked at presentations, I've heard sort of inside baseball about, you know, personalities, I guess, right? Interesting things about politics and things like that. But I'm kind of curious, like, how does one work even? Like, I know how CSS working group meetings work, and they're pretty much the same as how MathML working group works, which is pretty much the same as the what working group meetings work. And yeah, so how does one of these operate?
Usually, the chair of the 39. He's like one of the people responsible for running those meetings. So he might have a completely different view from everybody else actually attending those meetings. Like, from what I see during those meetings, like, we just all get around, well, a virtual table, and multiple, there are like maybe 30 to 40 delegates participating in these meetings, and everybody has their own goals. But the good thing is that we can only progress if our goals somehow align, which means that we basically have long structured discussions where some delegate gives a presentation about how they want language to evolve, like some features they want to add, and then everybody else like replies to the presentation with like their opinion and saying, yes, this is a good idea, no, this is terrible, or like you should tweak your thing in this and this way. And like, it's very much a collaborative process. Over time, we actually got better at talking, collaborating with each other. It used to be that you had to be the one shouting the loudest in the room for your opinion to be accepted. Now we have tools that make sure we all have like a civil discussion, like we enforce ordering, like whose turn is to speak now, and everybody speaks when it's their turn, and we make sure that everybody can always like reply, and there is nothing like having the last word on some topic. The discussions don't last forever, like they're all time boxed to make sure there is space for like every single presentation needs to happen to actually happen during the meeting. And sometimes we just do not agree on something within the time box, and then maybe we have to come back to future meeting, which is, it's fine. Like, the language doesn't need to evolve super fast. Yeah, it's like a bunch of friends sitting around a table, right?
Well, you'd expect so. I have to say, I mean, there's really many levels to it, however, right? Like, the work that we end up doing is a large spectrum. And on one side of the spectrum, you have the deeply technical work. So this is the kind of work that when we're talking about TC39 meetings, these sort of every 2 months, six times a year, therefore, three of them in person, these meetings are, while intense, are not the vast majority of the work that the committee does. One side of the spectrum is deeply technical work that goes on, right? Like figuring out certain details, working on the specifications themselves, the editorial work to sort of improve the lives of everyone, writing and reading these specs. That is done in sort of the opposite direction. It's quite decentralized. It's done by individuals, either editors or champions of certain proposals, and it goes on in the shadows, so to say, right? And then there's the non-technical, quote-unquote, work, where you have to basically solve these difficult problem of collaboration, because we have to all align a single, somewhat cohesive vision of what the language seems to sort of evolving towards, and we don't have any clear idea. JavaScript is like, it's well understood that it's a overly ambitious language that has sort of crept into everywhere, so the concerns are like numerous, and the stakeholders are all convinced that they're all on the right page. So it's a very difficult problem to solve, to create these meetings in a way that it's completely collaborative, that it's very respectful of all the individuals' times. Some of the proposals we've worked on have taken tens of years and still haven't sort of reached the point where they should have. So it's definitely a difficult problem. I feel like it works best when we're sort of on the same page regarding something, like usually smaller features or, you know, quality of life improvements that nobody has strong opinions on, basically.
So let's talk about specifically what happened in this meeting. This was the 109th meeting of TC39. You know, it's funny, like for, you know, something that's been around as long as JavaScript, it doesn't really sound like that much. That's always interesting to me when I pull that up. Yeah, I would think there would be several hundred meetings by now, but I guess not.
Yeah, fun fact, that's also a meaningless number. We don't exactly know how many meetings we had. It's like roughly 109. It's probably a little bit more. But at the beginning, we're just not very good at keeping track of all the meetings.
And how frequent are the meetings again?
Six times a year.
Okay. So every 2 months.
I think a good way to do this would be to sort of like give a quick recap of the sort of, you know, social media size these things presented or advanced or didn't advance, and then we'll dig into some specific ones maybe.
Yeah, sure. So I'm gonna split this by day just because it's easier to remember what happened each day. And like we started the meeting with the like more well, this always happened at the beginning of the meetings where we don't actually work on proposals, but more like language bugs or like problems we found, and we spend maybe the first morning talking about those. And at this meeting, we've discussed about some problem, like with the way function.prot.toString stringifies getters and setters, where apparently some browser tried to enter the spec and it ended up breaking some websites of some consulates somewhere in the world. And so they had to come to a committee to figure out what to do next, because that was clearly not web compatible. And we found a couple of aspect bugs. We talked about one with the order in which some promises related to modules are evaluated, are settled, where the spec says one thing, but all of the three browsers have three different behaviors. And so again, we discussed like how we align this. Like we would like everybody to behave the same, right? So that programs all work one way. And then also we discussed about a bug with typed arrays. Now that we have resizable array buffers, like they can shrink and grow. And there was a bug in one of the typed array methods, so it's copy within. It was not properly keeping track of when the underlying buffer was shrinking. And this can be dangerous because like typed arrays are very security sensitive, because like you have access to raw memory down there. So you need to make sure that things are working properly. And And then we had one last bug, but in the ECMA 42 spec, so about the Intel things, where that was actually presented by Joel, where like there was some function that was missing the function name property. And then continuing on the list of like things that are not actually proposals, we also talked about like some potential changes to the language to make it easier for browsers to optimize some common patterns. So it's about like freezing the array iterator prototype so that when you do array destructuring or array spread. So when you actually write the array destructuring syntax, it seems like something very, very simple, but there is a lot going on there. There is like this whole iterator protocol that the browser has to call, can trigger user code, and there are a bunch of side effects. And so we're discussing about how to make it like easier for browsers to optimize, at least for built-in arrays. And similarly, actually, it was like maybe the day after, we talked about how to make denables easier to use in browser. Denables are things that behave like promises but are implemented in userland. They're basically objects with a then method. And that can cause, like, it can both make it difficult to optimize things. It can also cause security issues in browsers because, like, every object has a then method could behave unexpectedly. And maybe your object itself doesn't have this then method, but it's installed somewhere in a prototype. Like if you do object.prototype.then equal a function, you're going to cause a lot of problems for a lot of browser internals that do not expect to call user code, but then actually they end up calling your function up there. And I believe for both of these discussions, we didn't reach any conclusion yet. It was just like, well, there's this problem. It will take a while before we figure out what to do. And then after these things, we go to the actual proposals. We had one stage for advancement in this meeting, the math.sumprecise thing that like does the sum of a bunch of numbers, trying to avoid floating point errors. And I think we also actually got a second postage for the 2x and 2base64 methods, and also from hex and from base64, so you can easily convert bytes to a base64 string. We had a bunch of stage 3 proposal updates, like temporal had again some very minor changes brought by implementation feedback. And we had like the map upsert proposal that advanced to stage 3 and the iterator concat proposal that tried to advance to stage 3. And then again, we had some updates about this in context. And then there was day 2.
Day 2, we had how to make denables safer that was briefly mentioned. Basically, how to improve these objects that have the then method. Also, error capture struct trace for stage 2.
Because all browsers shipped something and then they're all different behaviors, and so Mozilla is trying to align them.
The next one was to disallow adding new private fields to non-extensible objects. That seems like an oversight. And then after that, there was immutable array buffer for stage 3. So basically adding these immutable array buffers that can be more reliable for cross-agent communication using array buffers. Then we had iterator chunking for stage 2.7. So basically splitting up iterators into windows or slides. These are both words that they use. But yeah, like basically chunks of given size or up to a given size. That was part of the discussions. Then there was keep trailing zeros in Intel methods. So Intel number format and plural rules, both of them that deal with numbers in sort of the opposite ways, right? To keep the trailing zeros that are provided as the input. And yeah, sort of this related to some of our ongoing work and followed up by a mount. So this was the measure proposal that was renamed to a mount, which, you know, a pretty similar concept, but the idea is to represent these hybrid values, these compound values. And this was presented for stage 2.
Wow, and that's only day 2. How many days is the...
Well, but we're like two-thirds through the content, at least. Well, three-fourths through the content.
Okay.
Okay, so... Yeah. Nick.
And just to clarify, when a proposal is added to the agenda for like trying to reach a given stage, it doesn't mean that it will get to it. Like, for example, this amount proposal was for stage 2, but as a committee, we did not reach consensus on actually advancing it to stage 1. But then moving on, we had like another full day of discussions. Like in the during day three, we talk about the Intel amount code proposal that actually maybe Joel was working on, that improves like how Intel and Temporal work together with different era and mod codes, well, as the title says. And then we had a proposal about module import hooks and a global constructor. Module import hooks would be like a way to customize how module loading works with a shared API across all JavaScript environments. Like today, Node, you can have loaders, or in browser, you can have service workers. And global was like, well, constructor to build a new global. And these proposals were presented for stage one and got stage one, which means we're going to talk about it more. And also, we had the import buffer proposal that's now been renamed to import bytes, that lets you import some raw memory. That was on the agenda for stage one, but due to some last minute, like it actually got stage two already. And then in the afternoon, we just like continued talking about some of the previous things we talked about. Because like, as I said, all discussions are time boxed. And so maybe like something in the field time box. And then we had this free time, we just continued discussions. And then finally on day four, we had four proposals, all from the same champion working on Node.js, that were all about adding more methods to introspect objects. Like we have object keys, for example, to get the keys, the string keys. And the question was, well, how do we get the symbol keys? Or how do we count the properties of an object? Or how do we get the properties of an object that are not valid array numeric keys? Or like, how do we check if an array has holes? And a bunch of these proposals that Node.js would like to use for their internals, which are written in JavaScript. And they were all good for stage one or two. Some of them reached stage one, some didn't, but I don't remember which one did.
So is that, that's basically the list of things that got discussed?
Yes, which took 4 days full of this content.
Right. It seems like there's a fair number of things that are just about arrays, like making arrays better or immutable or being able to put arrays in other things. Is that a fair characterization, or am I just sort of seeing the word array and like imposing a pattern that's not really there?
And maybe it's not arrays, but things related to arrays also. Like you mentioned, you heard a lot of the word arrays because we also talked a lot about typed arrays. Or there are a bunch of proposals about iterators, like iterator chunking, iterator sequencing proposal. That were like, they're not really like arrays, but they're used in many places where arrays would also be used. And like, well, everybody uses arrays. It makes sense. We just want to make them better.
You know, I don't know if you have any favorites or ones that are like particularly interesting to you. I am keen on a few of these, but I don't know. Eric, do you have any that you particularly would like to?
I mean, I always want to hear about temporal, but I was going to say my understanding is that
what is the story
with
temporal?
Changed with temporal, like the spec itself. It's more that it advanced, or am I wrong about that?
It's about time for temporal.
Yeah, Tempro, by far the most popular TC39 proposal out there, from what we have seen from different surveys and so on, but also obviously the most popular one that we've worked on. It's going well, actually. Fingers crossed, touch wood, whatever sort of superstitious thing. But yeah, basically, like Tempro is in one of the final stages of engine implementation. In V8, basically, they've been doing a lot of hard work putting Rust into their build chains to basically do it via Temporal RS, which is a fantastic crate that does implement Temporal. And because of that, they raised a number of comments basically around sort of the tiny details that don't directly affect the average developer, I would say, things like the order of reading properties and such. And that was addressed. But the more I see these topics, the more I can't help but feel that Temporal is... Like, it's a matter of time, and I know that we keep saying that, but...
Yeah, it is a matter of time.
yeah, it's almost here. No pun intended, but basically, with the era month code proposal as well, like, adding some of the details that we're missing, I think we're very close to closing the picture out on Temporal, or at least finishing what things look like from our end. But Nicolo actually presented that topic. So
I think it's really interesting. We've seen some things where, like, Skia as the 2D library is just one. There's just basically one implementation that they all use. And I mean, it's, I don't think that it's totally not the case with other things. I think when it comes to, like, parser generators and things like that, they're just, like, common ones that everybody shares. What does that mean for how you think about interoperable implementations? Because do you have some requirement for stage advancement?
In the context of Desert 9, we never really had this thing where implementations were, like, sharing an underlying library for core language features. It happens for regular expressions where like both Chrome and Firefox, I believe, use the iRegex library or whatever it's called. But we always just count the number of browsers when it comes to our requirements. If this sharing code becomes more common in the future, we probably will have to, like, adjust our process that if, like, two browsers just share the same temporal implementation, maybe it should count as one. But there is still value in, like, multiple browsers shipping the same library because they have different user bases, so they can find, like, different web compatibility problems.
Yeah, I think one notable exception to this, however it's not part of the core sort of ECMAScript language, is the Intel side of the language. Like, it's all the browsers have some flavor of ICU powering it, mostly ICU for C, in these cases ICU for X. And I think we're starting to see a pattern here, right? Like earlier, I think 2 years at this point ago, Firefox was slightly, by Firefox I mean SpiderMonkey, was slightly slower than the rest in terms of shipping out this new feature at the time, which was Segmenter. The reason for that was that they spent a lot more time than the others setting up ICU4X in their build tool chain and everything. And the benefit of that is that we can see some things like Niccolo said, like Firefox is the only browser that ships temporal and flagged at this moment. So I think we can see that, like, you know, some of the efforts that they had made back then paid off. And I can see a similar thing with, like, you know, temporal RS. It might be very specific, but it's sort of essentially forced V8's hand at answering some of these difficult questions regarding, like, you know, basically shared code and, like, embedding these libraries, right, to implement certain features. So I think we're going to see basically good examples of this, hopefully, moving forwards, and just, like, more shared work, especially through ICU4X, because we can already see that, like, multiple stakeholders are quite interested in the proposition of ICU4X is, like, a more dynamic way to do internationalization than the existing solutions.
I don't think we define what ICU4X is, but it's the Rust library that contains all the information used for the Intel API. So all the local information for, like, and how to use this information together to, like, generate the right localized strings.
Some of the ones that I'm personally really interested in, chunking, I think, is, like, really interesting. Like, if you have an array and you want sort of, maybe it's got 10,000 items, but you want to handle them 10 at a time or something. Like, these are things that in my engineering career, chunking is something I had to do so many times. And having a nice iterator method like this seems, to me, really nice. I'm curious, can you, I don't know, what are the thoughts around it?
The proposal actually includes multiple methods, because when you want to get chunks out of a list, well, you go look at the details and there might be multiple ways in which you want to get chunks. Like, maybe you have, like, as you were saying, an array of 10,000 elements and you want to process 10 at a time. So you want to get first the first 10 and then the second 10, like from the 11th to the 20th, and then from the 21st to the 30th. And, like, so the proposal, well, obviously that adds a chunks method that does exactly that, where you can, like, define the size that you want. But then you might also want to have, like, a sliding, like, kind of a sliding window over all the values. Like, let's say you want to work on all the pairs of your list, like to check if your list is sorted or to compute some sort of rolling average. Then you want, like, to separate chunks, but you won't just have, like, from the first to the 10th and then from the second to the 11th and so on. And so this proposal also adds a Windows method for this. And then during this meeting, like, there was actually some sort of controversy about what Windows does. Cause, like, the question was, what happens when your list of values is shorter than the window size that you ask for? Like, let's say you have a list with like 10 elements and you want windows of 20. Then there were like two options there. One was to just give you no windows because, like, well, there is no way to give you a windows of 20 if you only have 10 elements. Like, for example, if your use case is to get all the averages of every pair and you have a list with just one element, you just cannot do it. And then the other approach would be to say, well, in that specific case, we actually do not respect your size and give you a smaller window. And we had a lot of discussions about this. We ended up, the proposal was presented again with like a third method to do these two separate fallback behaviors for the case in which you don't have enough elements. They were called like sliding and windows. We had some discussion about these being like bad names because they actually tell you what the difference is. And I think what we settled on was that we're actually going to have a single method called windows that takes, other than the window size, it takes an options bag or maybe like a string parameter, like an enum or something that tells you what to do in case you don't have enough elements. And the proposal was like going for stage 2.7, I think, but did not reach it because we first need to have the spec text for this updated approach that we want to go with.
You said that it advanced to a stage 2.7?
Mm-hmm. It actually didn't because of these last minute changes, but maybe, Joao, you want to explain what this stage 2.7 is?
Yeah, why is there a stage 2.7? Are there like 10 stages throughout the whole process?
This is not unusual or whimsical at all, I promise. Basically, this is a relatively new change to our stage process. So to go over it real quick, we have stages 0 till 4, where 0 implies something is pretty nascent, pretty new. It's not been presented to anyone seriously, but something that sort of resembles an idea, nothing more than that, or a problem statement, to be more precise, because we try to address problems more than bake up solutions out of thin air. And stage 4 being, this is like universally accepted part of the language. If you don't support this, then you're not consistent with the language spec. All of these different stages have different sort of implications regarding what kind of work we do, how ready the proposal is. And the issue that we had was that stage 2 is when you do the sort of big brain philosophizing and designing of the proposal, and large changes happen at that stage, and you write the spec out, basically. And stage 3 is when the engines are supposed to be implementing your proposal. So you stop designing things and you start actually putting things to code. The problem is that there's this awkward interstitial stage between these two where you're writing tests, right? Because you can't write tests before things are sort of set down, but you can also not do any implementations while there's no reliable tests or well sort of accepted tests that you can verify your implementation using. So that's what stage 2.7 aims to do. It's I believe it's 2.7 because of E, but in general, like, we just had the most chaotic open sort of brainstorming session, and people came up with all sorts of proposals. 2.9, 2.5, everything was discussed, and in the end we picked 2.7. It's adding a bit of whimsy to our sort of workflow, but the core idea is quite practical, is to give people this tiny bit of time to settle down the big sort of semantic and syntactic details of the proposal while not sort of pushing people to do the implementation in giving you sort of a no pressure environment to write the tests and then go for stage 3.
Okay. I have another question.
Go for it.
What's an upsert? Because I look at it.
Oh, yeah, that's one of the ones I'm most excited like about. Set so up for I'm a joke. Glad you
it's
asked.
Like, you know, what's up, sir? I don't know. What's up with you, sir? Wait, what? What's up, sir?
I would have liked if we kept it at absurd, to be honest. Like, the joke that you just made was hilarious. But I think a lot of people had this issue where they were like, yeah, it's not quite clear what absurd means. And so if you see, the actual function is called getter insert. And yeah, like basically that's the idea. Like some languages, I think, call it absurd as is. I don't think it's a bad name at all, but it's not very descriptive. And the idea is like a very common operation. Like I think when I write JavaScript, I do this as many times as I have maps, basically. Like anytime you have a map, you have to do this kind of dance where it's like, oh, does this property exist? If not, insert it. Or like, you know, replace it with the default value or replace it with the you know, result of the calling this function. And basically that's what this proposal provides. It's either get or insert, or get on insert computed, where you, instead of passing it a value, you pass in a callback, and the result of that callback is actually what's inserted at that key.
And this naming here was again a controversy point in the committee, because there are like two different type of delegates. One that thinks that the name should keep reflecting what the proposal actually does, like the functions, the proposal. So this proposal should have been renamed according to that like ideology to maybe proposal map get or insert. But then there is another type of thinking that is, no, people already know this proposal as the absurd proposal. And by renaming it, just everybody's going to get confused, because like, well, did the old proposal go? Did it just disappear while it was stage two? So the proposal actually absurd is a different operation. It's like update or insert and not get or insert. But we just kept name because we thought the proposal had like, was like maybe 5 years old at least at that point. And we thought it was just too late to rename it without causing extra confusion. And like, to be clear, the name is only matter for people that follow the process, because like once the proposal is stage four, nobody talks about the proposal anymore. They just talk about the API.
So the general idea is I'm sending a thing. If it already is there, then I update it. Then it gets updated. But if it doesn't exist, then it gets added or inserted.
Yeah. I mean, that's what absurd would do. But what we do here is that you basically are getting with a fallback, but the fallback gets inserted in the map.
Oh, okay.
Like, think if you have a cache, your map is a cache, you might want to either get the value from the cache, or if it's not there, put the new value in there and still use it.
Right. So why does this excite you, Brian?
Ah, because this is a thing that you need to do like constantly for caches and things. Like, it's really common patterns where you need to do this, and it would be nice to just have one, you know, very recognizable, very concise way to do it. So yeah, I think
absurd. You're down with the absurd.
I'm down for it. I'm down with the absurd. I would say the one that maybe excites me the most is early, but also way overdue in a way. So let me explain. So there's a proposal that's currently called amount. It kind of came from something, which I think you could argue kind of came from something else, and so on. Like, we're working on this, and I think also Mozilla. Before I continue, is that correct? Or yeah, okay. So part of the reason that this excites me is that there is also a proposal, is very early. It's just an explainer by it's authored by Tontek, our friend from Mozilla. And it covers some history, which I helped write some and fill some in. But like, microformats did a bunch of stuff in the mid 2000s. There was then another thing in 2010 to try and put like measures into markup somehow. And then then also a couple of years later, there was a thing proposed in Discord. We had a Discord where we were trying to do early incubation called Specifiction that was similar to that. 2019, this thing that Eric and I and Stephanie from Egalia were all involved in, this web we want. And part of when that started, it would go to events and there would be like a kind of a judges panel, and they would get submissions from the audience. They would come up and pick a few and present them. And then we would recognize certain ones of them as like a judges pick. So I don't know, sort of like that Shark Tank, basically, something like that, you know, but for standards. It was a nice way to sort of like listen to the community and include more people and stuff like that. But, you know, like what comes of it? And then again, in OpenUI, somebody proposed an M or a measure element. So anyway, like, you know, there is this long, 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 long history of people wanting to do these things where you say, like, this number represents 12 pounds or 12 kilograms or 12 dollars or whatever.
Teaspoons if you're...
Right, exactly. And, you know, for it to be possible to do useful things with that, that it's difficult for you to do without, like, for example, localization, right? So maybe you, part of the reason that it really excites me is that, you know, when we wrote this Extensible Web Manifesto, we had this idea of a platform that was like explainable, that you would have this, oh, we want this element, but then we also want this lower level thing where those same, the same guts are exposed to JavaScript, right? And I like that they're trying to coordinate and do it together. I don't know if it will work. It might not work, but I'm glad that Tontek was, you know, getting involved with the TC39 thing to
tell everybody what this amount proposal is. It's like, it's basically an object that holds a bunch of properties, like a number, and then a number of significant digits, so like the precision of the number. So you can say, oh, this thing is 1 meter long, or this thing is 1.00 meters long. So you know that like that's like actually more precise. And then, well, obviously the unit. And the idea is that, well, in JavaScript, you can already just have three variables that hold these three pieces of information and pass them around like wherever you need them. But it's just very annoying to have to do that manually, because like you just need to pass all of these things all over the place. And then if you create some custom object, you need to make sure that like the different libraries that need to work with these amounts need to understand the shape of your custom object. And like, for example, you will need to translate this custom object back into what the Intel API needs if you want to show these values to the user. And so by just defining these objects built in, well, everybody would just understand it. And like, you can have this single thing that represents 1.00 meters, and you could pass that to Intel.number format, for example, and it will localize properly 1.00 meters in the language of your users. And like giving all this like very nice single way of doing one thing. And the amount proposal was actually not born really in collaboration with the people working on that amount HTML element. It just happens to map very well.
No, they're parallel evolutions. Yeah, definitely parallel evolutions. But the need has been
expressed. And like, I'm hoping that one day we'll get the more declarative and like semantic way of doing so. It's like good to have the HTML element because like, well, it actually has more semantic meaning than just having the string 1.0 meter embedded in there. Like, I don't know, maybe.
I think part of the thing that would be really helpful about that is that, you know, like today I can pull up a page in Spanish and my browser can say, hey, this appears to be in Spanish. Do you want us to translate it for you? And you can hook up even which translation services you prefer. You know, if I could identify that this is an element and like maybe when I hover it or I select it, it could give me the ability to make it make sense to me because I live in America and for some reason we don't use the units of measurement that everybody in the rest of the world does. And so when I see, you know, this journey is 32 kilometers, I really have no idea on a lot of these things. That's probably saying a lot about me, but I think that it's the same when you're reading something written, you know, by an American. Fahrenheit to Celsius is really common, right? Like I just want to do that all the time. So like today now, if a lot of browsers, if you select a word, there's a like, hey, translate it or look it up in a dictionary, because those are really common actions that people take on a word, or we run some regular expressions over it and it looks like a phone number. We can say, hey, you're on a phone. Did you want to dial that phone number? Or it's marked up like an address. Then, you know, your phone can say, hey, did you mean to ask for directions to this? Do you want to see it on a map? So I think really that's the advantage that I see a lot to the semantic adding of these things, is that for a user, like an end user, I can imagine this would be really, really useful if people start marking up those, because browsers then can add lots of affordances that help us understand one another better.
I would describe it as sort of a evolution also in terms of just the fundamental mental model that we work with internationalization. I think over the years, we've gradually worked our way through some of the bad practices, right? Like we've done a good job, but when it comes to things like number formats, right? Like number formats allows you to to actually plug in any unit and format things with a unit. Now you have a constructor for the number format. You can give it a bunch of options like, okay, I want to format this number like a currency, and this currency should be euros. But the end result is that you have, you know, the flow of data is not ideal here. The reason for this is that, like, if I say something like 1.45 euros or something for a product, let's say, removing euros and removing the fact that it's a currency from that number actually makes that number completely meaningless, right? So it's important context that should be part of the number rather than the formatter itself. And the formatter should consume the number and the unit in, like, you know, the relevant context by itself. And then that would be, it would be able to do some smarter things like converting it to a different unit that, like, you know, is more relevant for a locale. It can convert it to a different unit that might be relevant for the amount that it is, right? Like for a certain distance, inches might be more relevant than feet or miles. So like all of these things, I think, like, is part of the overall movement in the Intel space, where people are realizing, like, oh, okay, we can actually address this problem a lot better by changing how we, like, you know, what we call a unit of information, basically.
And there is also a related proposal in 39. It's called Smart Units, that our colleague Ben Allen was working on, where basically you'll be able to say, look, I have this quantity. It's like 1.78 meters, and it represents the height of a person, and my user's locale is set to EN US. Please convert it to the right amount in the right unit to represent the height of a person in this user's locale, so that then my website can just directly show the right thing that the user would understand.
One thing that gets a little bit tricky with any of them is that some of these are, you know, like, I think it's like temporal, in that we like, from our point of view and time, you're just inclined to be like, well, there's 12 months in a year. There's this many days in each month, and there's this many hours in each day. And it's like, well, it's a little bit more complicated than that, you know? It's not actually really simple. There's a lot of things that changed and change over time. And if you're trying to calculate backwards in time, you have to account for all these weird anomalies. And one thing that seems really common and would be really useful is to do with money. And money is like, feels like it would be hard to convert like that. You know what I mean? Because it's like not fixed in time. It's variable. You would want to do it sort of like at the time of consumption or something like that. But it also feels like it would be really hard to build like some of those conversions, like monetary ones, into any system. Has there been any, like, on your smart units, does it account for money? Because, like, the amount thing, definitely money is one of the...
Yeah, unfortunately, money is explicit out of scope, because, like, as you said, there isn't, like... Well, not only browsers cannot, like, hard-code a conversion rate, like, for example, between euros and dollars, because that changes all the time. But, like, even at any point in time, if, like, your thing costs, like, $10 and you're selling it to some European user... How much European user pays actually depends, like on their own bank, for example. So there is no way you can actually predict that and show it properly. So we just consider it to be a too difficult problem, and people will have to solve this problem, probably not in the browser, but like very close to where their payment system is implemented.
I think converting between currencies is impossible, but sort of keeping all that information together allows you to actually at least have the context that, like, okay, I think it's a different currency than the one that I was expecting, and therefore I need to keep the conversion angle in mind and not assume that it's going to stay unchanged.
I don't know, Eric, Nick, have you put forth the things that you were sort of most excited about?
Well, we discussed Temporal. I guess I'm still quite excited about Temporal. I am cynically excited about Intel Era Month Code in the sense that it's a lot of work and it's a difficult proposal to get through. So I guess that's the selfish part. but the best part is actually that it's doing something quite impactful. I think this is going to be one of the first few times that we actually have a very featureful version of different calendars, you know, non-Gregorian calendars available to like this large set of software users. So I think it's going to be quite interesting to see where things go from there, like what people are going to do once they get a hold of like the, let's say, Hebrew calendar, and they can do calculations in the Hebrew calendar. They can add a month to a date in the Hebrew calendar and know, like, okay, it's a leaf month, so things are going to behave in a different way. I'm quite excited to see where things go from there, because one thing that's easy to sort of forget is that since the days of like dates and times basically on computers, we've always only really used one calendar, right? Like practically speaking, we've used one calendar for everything, and then we've gradually sort of sprinkled others as like, you know, end user formats. Like you can keep a date sort of in the ISO format, but then display it to a user in, like, you know, with the corresponding in the Hijri calendar, let's say. And now the ability for people to actually work with these calendars to express their state in the terms of these dates, I think it could be quite interesting.
We're talking about favorites. Actually, one of my favorite proposals we presented during this meeting that we didn't really cover today was this in context one. It's like another proposal that, well, another colleague of us, Andrea, is working on. And it basically lets you preserve some state through the like logical async flows in your code. So that if you like have some state at some point, and then you wait, and then you have a set timeout, and then you need to read that state, and you have some other code doing the same thing in parallel with some different initial state, each of them can like very easily keep track of what their async context was. And this is very useful, for example, for frameworks, where whenever like we write components in like React or Svelte and any of those, there's like some implicit state being tracked about what the current component is. Like in React, for example, have hooks that need to be properly connected to the component. And all of them have like different ways of doing this that relies on global state. And all of the ways that they do it just breaks when you use async code, which is why most of these frameworks do not let you use a wait in components, or if they do, it's like under very strict restrictions. And async context will like just make it possible for this to work without the user of the framework having to worry about it. And also it's very useful for things like performance tracing, where maybe you have a large app. Like it doesn't matter like my small personal website, but like if I'm developing, I don't know, Google Maps, where there's like a ton of JavaScript interacting like and running all the time, and maybe something is slow and I need to figure out why it's slow, and I need to get metrics from like how people interact with the page to figure out, okay, you press this button and it took more than half a second to respond because it goes through all of this pipeline of code that likely includes some async steps like a non-network request. And like with this in context, I can use tracing libraries that actually build this like tree of how code causes their code to run, and then it takes some time, and then at the end there is something shown to the user. And right now it's very difficult to do this performance limitation on the web because you can only do it for synchronous code, because you lose the context across async points, which are just very common on the web platform. And so yeah, hopefully async context will happen and will help solving all of this. It's a stage two right now. The Desire 9 part is mostly done, but like it's it had to slow down because there is a lot of work and we need to figure out exactly how it interacts with all of the asynchronous web APIs.
Yeah, I really like that one too. Came from Java and it's like a lot like thread local. So I'm keen to see
so
what happens there.
Nick Ushwal, thank you for joining us and maybe we'll do it again in the future.
Thanks
for having us here.